Welcome back. So today we'll do we'll discuss a particular singularity theorem, and we'll prove it. And the point is, on one hand, to show a very important result, but also to illustrate what it needs to overcome the existence of singularities. So if quantum gravity is to somehow overcome singularities, then it will have to overcome that theorem.
I was just wondering if we're going to finish the last lecture or skip the last bit. I'm just wondering if it's relevant.
Yes, yes. So I took the slides that we didn't get to at the last lecture, and I prepended it to the present lecture. So we are not skipping any slides. This is where we ended last time, and that's where we will pick up. Okay, so I mentioned it already at the end of the last lecture. Today we'll go through it in detail and see what every little part of it means and prove it. So the singularity theorem, I don't know whether that's exactly the one that Hawking proved in his PhD thesis, but it's one of a class of singularity theorems of that time, of the early 70s. So here's the singularity theorem. Assume that we have a space-time manifold which is globally hyperbolic, and assume that the energy momentum tensor of matter obeys the so-called strong energy condition. This is a restriction on the type of matter that is allowed in our setup here. And we will later see what that restriction on matter is, what it means for that matter. To anticipate it, it means that it has to be matter that is of a kind which does not make space-time expand. Ordinary matter makes space-time shrink. It makes it attractive. And the strong energy condition enforces that. You will later see that only matter that, if distributed in space-time evenly and dominant, would lead to inflation. Exactly, that's the kind of matter that would violate the strong energy condition. Okay, so we impose the strong energy condition. So we assume it is true. We assume that there is no matter in the universe that would violate the strong energy condition. And we assume that there is a Cauchy surface on which, technically speaking, the trace of the extrinsic curvature k is bounded from above by some negative constant. And we will translate that into the statement that space-time is expanding at least a certain minimum rate on that space-like hypersurface. So under these assumptions, the theorem says that no path-directed time-like curve from our space-like hypersurface sigma can have an eigentime that is proper length larger than 3 over c, which is to say nothing is older than 3 over c, which is to say that there was a singularity in the past. So all path-directed time-like geodesics are incomplete, which means inextendable even when parameterized to only a finite parameter value. And that means that there is a cosmological singularity in the finite past. We call it cosmological singularity because it's true for all curves. All path-directed time-like curves from our space-like hypersurface, backwards in time because they're path-directed, must have a finite proper length. And since it applies to all of those curves, it means that no matter where you start, if you run back in time, eventually you hit a singularity. So there was a singularity for everything. It was not like a black hole that has a localized singularity. It was a cosmological singularity in the sense that all past geodesics will meet that singularity. Nobody avoids it. So, among the conditions for the singularity theorem was a condition on the extrinsic curvature. So, what is the extrinsic curvature? We'll later study it in more detail. For now, let me say that the extrinsic curvature of a space-like hypersurface describes how much curvature there exists between the space-like hypersurface and the time dimension. Imagine you have a two-dimensional surface embedded in three-dimensional space. Then you can ask how much is that two-dimensional surface curved against the three-dimensional space, against the other dimension. And here we are asking that for space-time. Now you may wonder, so what is curvature between space and time? Curvature between space and space directions, we know. It's when you have this parallel transport and you go along a parallelogram and you come back and then it has been a rotation in the vector that you parallel transported. But what if one of your directions in the parallelogram is timeline? So you sort of go in a parallel transport to the future, and then you go into some space direction, and then you parallel transport back to the time that you started in, and you parallel transport back in space. And then if the vector has rotated, that's what curvature is between space and time. What could that be? But actually, we do have intuition for this. It's expansion. It's expansion or shrinkage of space-time. That shows up in such parallelograms. So as I said, the condition on the extrinsic curvature is a condition on the expansion rate. So the logic of this theorem is that if certain technical conditions are met, such as the strong energy condition, and if at a certain point in time, in other words, on a space-like hypersurface, if at a particular point in time, the space-time is expanding at a certain minimum rate everywhere, so it's everywhere expanding and nowhere slower expanding than a certain amount, then the theorem concludes that, in effect, it must have been expanding before, and it must have, if you go back in time, it must have shrunk to the extent that it actually reached a singularity, as detected by geodesics. So we are not actually trying to solve the Einstein equation. Instead, the trick is to look at the geodesic equations and see if geodesics collide in the past, and therefore we have singularities. I shouldn't say geodesics colliding. It's really that the geodesics, that if you have a bundle of geodesics, they get compressed and over time. And if the compression is infinite, that's when you have a singularity there. That's when they are no longer extendable. All right, so intuitively, the extrinsic curvature is the rate of the expansion of space-time. Or more precisely, it's actually, its negative is the rate of contraction. So if we assume that the extrinsic curvature is smaller than some finite amount c smaller than zero, then it means that space-time has a finite minimum expansion rate at a particular point in time, which is to say on a particular space-like hypersurface, which is a Cauchy surface. Of course, this business with the expansion rate, we will have to discuss in great detail in order to make that accurate. Let's for a moment come back to the strong energy condition. That also went into our singularity theorem. Let's remember we already had energy conditions. One of the energy conditions was a weak energy condition. And its formulation is that the energy momentum tensor contracted with time-like vector fields V should be positive. And what was the meaning of that? Well, the meaning is that for an observer with a unit tangent V, and every observer has a time-like tangent vector, so for any observer with a unit tangent vector V, which is time-like as required here, the local energy density is then larger or equal to zero. You see, if you are a local observer, you can, if you're an observer, you can choose a coordinate system that travels with you. So you're not traveling in space, you're only traveling in the time direction. And that means that your vector v has a zero component, but it has no space component. Your tangent vector, to your world line only has a zero component, but no one, two, or three component. Which means that this contraction here just picks out T naught naught. And T naught naught is the energy density. So this is a requirement that says that we assume that the energy density will be found positive by any observer. Probably not true. Quantum fields can violate that. Then, but classically, it probably makes sense. Then the dominant energy condition is also an energy condition that we already had. And it is based on the weak energy condition, but it's a slightly stronger thing. The dominant energy condition requires this condition, the weak energy condition. So T naught naught is positive for all observers. But it also requires that this vector here, k mu, which is obtained by multiplying the energy momentum tensor with the tangent vector, with a time-like tangent vector, is itself time-like. Now, you remember this vector k mu? It came up earlier. Whenever we have a killing vector field, and v is a killing vector field, then that vector k mu is a conserved four momentum. It gives you a conserved quantity. Now, the dominant energy condition is a condition that is often assumed in the absence of killing vector fields. Killing vector fields are not important for that argument here. I just want to say that if there are symmetries, if there is a killing vector field, then k mu describes the flow of energy and momentum. In the absence of a killing vector field, k mu, this combination, still describes the flow of energy and momentum of an observer here, as seen by an observer here. And what the dominant energy condition then means is that that flow ought to be time-like. That's why it's negative, time-like. So in other words, the meaning is that the weak energy condition says T naught naught, the energy density, should always be positive. The dominant energy condition says that energy may not be conserved, but we do want that the flow of energy, be it conserved or not, we want that the flow of energy is in a time-like direction, is slower than the speed of light. So that's this extra condition there. Now, the strong energy condition is the condition that our theorem requires. And the strong energy condition was the condition that this particular combination of the energy momentum tensor, not just T mu nu as we had it earlier, but that this particular combination of the energy momentum tensor, where this is its, this particular combination contracted with time-like vector fields is larger than zero. To be honest, that condition is imposed because it's exactly what is needed to make the singularity theorem provable. So it doesn't originally stem from any intuition about conditions that the matter content in the universe, the actual matter content in the universe, is obeying. But there is an interpretation if you look for it. Namely, if this condition is obeyed, then we are excluding matter which could cause an accelerated expansion of the universe. So if there was matter that could cause an accelerated expansion of the universe, which is to say which would have an equation of state parameters smaller than minus a third, then that matter would violate the strong energy condition.
Why is that?
We will see it in a moment. We will show it. Is that a plausible condition? Kind of, yes. We don't know of any matter that would violate the strong energy condition. However, the Clairgeon field can, and a cosmological constant can. Now, what is the relationship of, and we need that, of course, for inflation and to describe the actual accelerated expansion of the universe. What's the relationship, you may ask, of the strong energy condition to the weak and the dominant energy condition? And it turns out that it's independent. You can have that this is obeyed or not obeyed independently of whether the other two are obeyed or not obeyed. There's a way to reformulate the energy conditions so that they become slightly more concrete. So for known matter, T mu nu can always be diagonalized. The energy conditions, when T mu nu is diagonal, the energy conditions then take this form. The weak energy condition says, as we just discussed, that T naught naught, the energy density, is positive. And it also says that rho plus pi is larger equal to zero for each I, so for each direction with the pressure. The dominant energy condition says that these conditions have to hold, and in addition, that condition should also hold. It's not immediately obvious why the conditions that we had on a previous slide translate into those, but it's not hard to see either. And the strong energy condition says that the energy density plus the sum of the pressures is larger equal to zero. So that's just a matter of rewriting the condition, the strong energy condition that we had on the previous slide. If you rewrite it in a basis in which T mu nu takes this diagonal form, then you get this condition. But from this condition, you can easily see that what it takes to violate the strong energy condition is exactly that you have matter that could cause inflation. And the reason is this. Remember the definition of the equation of state parameter. The equation of state parameter W is P, is P, the pressure, divided by the energy density. And that ratio between pressure and energy density has a threshold value of minus a third. If it's smaller than minus a third, then, as we saw in previous lectures, we have accelerated expansion. But imagine that P is minus a third or less rho, right? That means exactly that this thing goes negative. I'm assuming here that all the pressures are the same. So in the case of isotropy, I should qualify what I said earlier. In the case of isotropy, where all the directions in space are equal, we have that if and only if the equation of state parameter is smaller than minus a third. So if and only if matter is inflationary, or if and only if the dominant contribution to the energy momentum tensor has an equation of state parameter, a ratio of pressure to energy density, which is smaller than minus a third, then the strong energy condition is violated because the left-hand side goes negative. So if we consider, for example, the situation today, where we seem to have a cosmological constant that's actually dominating the energy momentum tensor by contributing 70% of all the energy density, then this cosmological constant actually leads to a violation of the strong energy condition. However, today, the universe is very much diluted. Matter has been diluted, radiation has been diluted, and only the cosmological constant, because it is constant and doesn't dilute at all, no matter how much the universe expands, the energy density from the cosmological constant is always the same because it's constant. So the universe today is very much diluted, and that's the reason why the cosmological constant now dominates. But we are not interested at the moment in the universe today. We are interested in the cosmological singularity, so we are asking, how did the universe behave very early on? And very early on, the cosmological constant was tiny compared to the energy density due to matter and due to radiation. It was only a few billion years ago, like 2 or 3 billion years ago, that the energy momentum tensor became dominated by the cosmological constant. All the time before, it was dominated by matter, and even before, it was dominated by radiation. All right, we had a list from A to E of a strategy of how we prove singularity theorems. And point E was the last step there, where we said that given the strong energy condition, one can show that geodesics meet a divergence. So if we consider a kind of a bundle of geodesics, that this bundle of geodesics will be compressed. In fact, you could take a bundle of geodesics that's arbitrarily fat, and all of those geodesics would crunch together into compression in a finite proper time. But this compression, this business of geodesics approaching each other and not just sort of getting tangent to each other and just peacefully coexisting, but actually having their distance shrink and eventually all of the distances shrink to zero. That business we need to look at much more closely now. Especially because when you think of geodesics as a kind of the output of a spaghetti machine or something like this, you have lots of those little lines emanating from there. You can imagine that they not only can, as a whole, contract and get closer and closer, or diverge and go further and further away from each other, they can also rotate. And they can also squish in one direction and expand in the other. All of those things are possible. Let us study that, so that we can then eventually pin down how a singularity comes about. So to study that, oh, and by the way, this study, the tools that we will use to prove the singularity theorem are tools that are also useful for other purposes. Namely, whenever you have a stream of objects, such as molecules of a gas or larger objects streaming on geodesics, for example, in black hole physics or supernova physics and so on. Whenever you have matter moving on geodesics, so parallel geodesics, or almost parallel ones. So our aim is to define the expansion rate, not of space-time directly, but expansion of bundles of geodesics, or the shrinkage, as the case may be. So for that purpose, let us introduce a definition that's better than bundle of geodesics or spaghetti machine or something like that. The technical term is a congruence of time-like geodesics. So we pick a point in time, so we pick a space-like hypersurface, and then we pick a smoothly defined family of time-like geodesics. So through every point on that space-like hypersurface, this is geodesic now, and so every point on the space-like hypersurface, from every point, there is exactly one geodesic emanating. And we are parameterizing those geodesics each by their proper time. Proper time being zero, exactly on the space-like hypersurface, and then proper time passes. Then the tangent vector field to this bundle of geodesics, to this congruence of geodesics, the tangent vector field is then a vector field psi, which in some funny coordinate system, some arbitrary coordinate system, will have some complicated representation. But we can also always write it as psi is d by d tau, because it is the tangent vector to the geodesics, and that's the proper time direction. So if you express the proper time in terms of the coordinates of your coordinate system, then you can write this out as usual.
The meeting has ended
in terms of an ordinary coordinate system, but it's convenient to write it like this. It's a proper time, and the speed of the geodesic or the world line length of the geodesic is always minus one. Now let us consider a one-parameter subfamily of these geodesics. So this is, here's our spaghetti machine, and these are the geodesics that emanate from it. Right? So at every point there is output one geodesic. And the tangent vector field to the geodesics is the vector field xi. So if you take this event here, for example, then the tangent vector field is called xi at this point. And it is d by d tau, for the where tau is the proper time of this particular geodesic. Over there, it would also be d by d tau, but now it's the proper time of that geodesic. Overall, the entire vector field is called xi. But now we are looking not at all of the output of the spaghetti machine, but just one line of output. So we are parametrizing now geodesics, let's say from left to right, so we take just one line of them. And let's parameterize them with a parameter that we may call S. And so if you are here on that geodesic, then you can go over there to that geodesic by following a direction vector that we will call eta. And the proper distance, the derivative with respect to the proper distance is d by ds. So in other words, these black lines here are lines of constant tau value. So this is where each of those geodesics has reached a proper a particular value of its proper time. So this might be, for example, the line of t equals 0. This is where the output is from the spaghetti machine. And then they go out all like this. And these are the points of equal proper time varying over the geodesic. On the other hand, these are the geodesics. So here the proper time is varying, but the parameter S is not varying, right? So we parameterize the geodesics from left to right with respect to the parameter S. And we parameterize one geodesic for a fixed value of S in this direction with respect to the proper time tau. So the challenge is to study how this congruence of geodesics, in particular this one parameter family of geodesics, behaves under the Einstein equation. And that amounts to the question of how, where is it? Oh, went too far. That amounts to the question how this particular vector eta is evolving over time. Eta, the vector that points from one geodesic to its neighboring geodesic. If, for example, we find that two geodesics that have just been produced by the spaghetti machine, if those two geodesics run into a particular space-time curvature, then it could be that those two geodesics start orbiting each other like this, which means that this eta vector, because it keeps track of individual geodesics, would rotate along with that. If, on the other hand, two geodesics start diverging from each other, they go further away from each other, then this vector eta would grow in length. So how does eta change along a geodesic? So we're traveling in the picture from before, we're traveling along a geodesic, and we ask, how does eta change? So for a geodesic traveler who travels on one, for a traveler who travels on one of those geodesics, we can have the tau is the proper time of that traveler, and S is a proper distance, and therefore these are Riemann normal coordinates for that traveler. And then we have in that coordinate system d by dt, d by ds is equal to the other way around, just by the property of ordinary derivatives to commute. But these are vector fields, and as vector fields, we therefore have that the commutator between xi, the vector field of the d by d taus and the eta are commuting. Now remember that we do not have torsion, and the torsion tensor can be written in this way. So the absence of torsion means that zero equal to that expression, and we just showed that this is vanishing. But that means that we have that the covariant derivative of eta with respect to xi is equal to the covariant derivative of xi with respect to eta. So we have this equation here. So when two vector fields commute, then we have this condition here in the absence of torsion. Now let's spell out what that is. So remember, the covariant derivative in the direction of a vector field xi can be spelled out more explicitly by writing the xi as xi mu e mu, xi being the coefficient functions and e being the basis vectors. The coefficient functions can always just be pulled out. So we have the xi mu here, and here's just the basis vector left over. We can do the same thing on the right. We obtain this equation here. Now we have to covariantly differentiate this expression with respect to the direction vector e mu, and similarly over here. Remember how that works? Product rule, Leibniz rule, right? This is a function, and that is a vector. The covariant derivative of a function is the ordinary derivative. The covariant derivative of a basis vector produces a Christoffel symbol. So what we get is two terms, an ordinary derivative of eta and the Christoffel symbol thing. The two together, remember, are called the semicolon. It's just a covariant derivative. So what we have is that this expression is really that expression. And similarly here, xi beta semicolon alpha. Now that's true for each of the basis vectors. So we can just set the coefficients equal. The coefficients of the basis vectors have to be equal when the basis vectors are equal. So we obtain this equation here. And that's an important result, because here we have the covariant derivative of the vector field eta in the direction of xi, which is what we are after. We want to know, how does eta change as we travel along the geodesic xi? That's what we calculate here. That's what we calculated this for. And we find that this is this, which is that, and here we identify eta alpha, and then this thing with two indices, which we may call a matrix B. Okay, so we define here matrix B, which is the covariant derivative of xi in all directions. So that's an interesting equation here. The structure of it is the following. We want to know how eta is changing along xi. That's the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, we see that the way that eta is changing is given by a matrix acting on eta. And you see that? We should probably write this the other way around, just so that you see that this is a matrix contracted with this vector. So we're asking, how does this vector eta change along the geodesic? We want to know that because we want to know whether two geodesics orbit each other or go away from each other or get closer to each other. So the rate of change of eta is given by eta applied to this matrix. So therefore, we will find out what two geodesics will do relative to each other if we find out what's up with this matrix B. For example, if this matrix B, just intuitively speaking, if that was consisting of lots of very small numbers, it would mean that this eta vector shrinks and the two geodesics would get closer. If B is something very large with lots of large coefficients, we would expect that the two geodesics diverge from each other. If B is a rotation matrix or a Lorentz transformation matrix, then we would expect that the two geodesics orbit each other. So we need to find out what this matrix B is doing to find out what those geodesics are doing. And remember where we want to apply it. We have a space-time according to the assumptions of the singularity theorem. We are looking at a space-like hypersurface of the space-time when the space-time was expanding everywhere at a certain finite minimum rate. Or put it differently, where the geodesics were diverging, where the geodesics were moving apart from each other at a certain minimum rate. And what we wonder is, what if you follow that backwards in time? Will you reach a singularity? If so, it should show up in the behavior of B. B should have a singular behavior for the geodesics to have a singular behavior. So let's see what's going on with the matrix B. So along the geodesics direction psi, the deviation vector eta changes its direction and length as given by this expression here, by the matrix B acting on the vector eta. So we have this tensor here, B nu mu, which is the covariant derivative of the tangent vector of the geodesics. And this tangent, this matrix B, we will now decompose. B mu nu can always be written in this form. There is no physics in this. This is just saying mathematically, we can decompose any matrix in this way. And we will do it here now because it has a direct physical interpretation. So this matrix B mu nu can be decomposed into three parts canonically. The first part is the anti-symmetric part of that matrix. And the remnant is the symmetric part of that matrix. You can always decompose any matrix uniquely into the sum of an anti-symmetric matrix and the symmetric matrix. So that's the first decomposition, anti-symmetric part plus symmetric part. Then the symmetric part can also be canonically decomposed into two matrices. Again, nothing special about gravity here. For every matrix, you can do this. Namely, you can decompose a symmetric matrix always into a symmetric matrix whose trace is zero, and the symmetric matrix whose trace is finite. So let's do this. And let's write sigma mu nu for the part that has no trace. So this is a symmetric matrix without a trace. And that's then the rest, which is a symmetric matrix with a finite trace. We'll see in a moment how to actually calculate these things. In particular, right away, we can say that the anti-symmetric part is clearly this, right? So you take your B mu nu, and you write down B mu nu minus B nu mu, one half of that. Well, there you have it. That's the anti-symmetric part of your matrix. The symmetric part is obtained similarly, just with a plus sign here, but we need more than that. We need a decomposition into sigma mu nu and t mu nu, the traceless and the traceful part. In preparation for that, for that decomposition, let's define a projector. And that's going to be a projection matrix. Of course, these things depend on space and time, right? So this is really a tensor field. But in any case, I will talk about it as if it was just, in the singular. So we define this projector matrix, H mu nu, and as I will show in a moment, this H mu nu is a projector onto the subspace of vector fields that are orthogonal to the tangent to our geodesics. See, xi is the tangent field to our geodesics, and rxi is the vector space that is generated by the geodesics tangent vector field. And H mu nu is going to be the projector onto the space orthogonal to that. Now, the claim is that this projector, H mu nu, is given by G mu nu plus xi mu xi nu. So this is supposed to be the projector onto space-like directions, because it's orthogonal to the time-like direction.
Oh,
real numbers.
Oh, okay.
When you take a vector and you multiply it with all real numbers, you get the real vector space, the one-dimensional real vector space spanned by that. It's just a convenient notation. Okay, so if this really is the promised projector, then we should be able to check that. So let's apply this projector onto an arbitrary four-vector or four-vector field, and then check whether it is really orthogonal to our tangent vectors. That's the claim, after all. We are projecting onto the space that's orthogonal to our space of tangent vectors. So let's check. We take this vector here, I write it here again, and then we calculate the inner product with our tangent vector field. And the claim is this inner product has to be zero, because this guy is supposed to be orthogonal to the tangent vector field now. So let's work it out. The h mu nu is this, so we really get two terms here. We get one term which is psi mu g mu nu w nu from that g mu nu. And we get another term where we have psi mu and then psi mu again and then psi nu and then w. So this is the term where we have the metric. Right, so it's psi metric w, that's this, the inner product between psi and w. And we have the other term where we have these two going in here. So we have psi xi and psi w, psi xi and psi w. But the inner product of psi with itself is minus 1, because that's the tangent to the geodesics. And therefore, we have this minus itself, and that's zero. So indeed, this thing is projecting onto the subspace of four vectors that are orthogonal to the tangents of our geodesics. Now, finally, we can define the expansion, which is to say the rate at which the geodesics are approaching each other or diverging from another. And that expansion theta is defined to be the trace of, on, I should say, well, it's a spatial part of the B mu nu matrix. Spatial part in the sense that we are contracting with the spatial projector here. It's not obvious why this would be the expansion, but we will see in a moment. So we look at this definition here. Theta is b mu nu h mu nu. H mu nu, remember, is this projector onto the subspace orthogonal to the geodesics. And the claim is that the trace of b is theta. So let's see whether that's true. We have defined theta to be b mu nu contracted with the projector. But the projector has two terms. It has a g mu nu term and it has a psi xi term. So let's work it out. We have b mu nu contracted with h, is b mu nu contracted with the g term and with the psi xi term. This first term is the trace. See, the trace is obtained by contracting with the metric, right? So this is the trace, contracting b with the metric. And here we have psi mu and then psi nu b mu nu. But if we remember what the B matrix was, it was the covariant derivative of the tangent vector field. We can contract that with psi, and we simply get that this is the geodesic condition. It's that the parallel transport of the tangent in the direction of the tangent is zero. So that term is vanishing, because this is vanishing. So we have indeed shown that the expansion can also be viewed as the trace of the B matrix. Okay, so that means we can now write the decomposition of the symmetric part of the B matrix completely. We can write the traceless part of the B matrix. The traceless part was called sigma mu nu. We can write it as the symmetric part of the B matrix, by definition, minus some coefficient times theta times that spatial projector here, because this is exactly the traceful part of the symmetric part of the B matrix. And the part with the remaining part of the symmetric part of the B matrix is the T matrix, and it is 1/3 theta times H mu. Why this is a third is explained here. It's a little calculation there. Doesn't really matter. So the point is, we have now decomposed the, maybe I show you the original decomposition again. Here it is. Here it is. So we've now decomposed the B matrix into its anti-symmetric part, and the symmetric part we have decomposed into the traceless part and into the traceful part, where the traceless symmetric part is sigma mu nu, and it's this expression, and the traceful part is this part. You may wonder why so much emphasis on this business with the trace. What role does the trace play? Why do we distinguish? Why don't we just decompose into anti-symmetric and symmetric? Well, the point is that the traceful part, the traceful part on its own, is solely responsible for geodesics gaining distance or losing distance. Everything else, the anti-symmetric part and the symmetric traceless part, are only moving the geodesics around each other, but they are not getting them on average. They're not taking the bundle and making the bundle of geodesics shrink or making the bundle of geodesics expand, as we will see now. So let's look at these three terms and see what they do. So the omega mu nu part, the anti-symmetric part, well, it's by definition anti-symmetric. And if you remember, these guys, exactly all those matrices that obey that condition, twofold covariant matrices with anti-symmetry, are exactly the matrices that generate infinitesimal Lorentz transformations. And technically, you will have to raise one of the indices to make it a Lorentz transformation. But if you lower the indices, this is the condition to have infinitesimal Lorentz transformations. But on the other hand, our eta are all orthogonal to the time direction. And so it turns out that all you do with the omegas is rotate the etas in space. So what we have is that the omega mu nu generates spatial rotations of neighboring geodesics around each other, which is also why omega mu nu is called the twist tensor. So omega mu nu, if it's non-zero, means that it will make two geodesics, two neighboring geodesics, rotate each other, either clockwise or counterclockwise, but that's all that happens. And it will take all of them. It will, if you take a ring of geodesics, for example, then all that omega mu nu will do is that it will keep the radius of the ring the same. If this is a ring of geodesics, then it will keep that ring of geodesics at the same radius, at the same size, but they rotate like this while they move. So the ring is just moving straight, but the individual geodesics rotate like that. So they go in a spiral like this. Now one can prove, and that's a bit non-trivial, that if one chooses the congruence of geodesics that one starts with in such a way that they're orthogonal to the space-like hypersurface, then we have that the omega mu nu is actually vanishing. The second term is the traceless symmetric part of the B matrix. So it obeys this condition here, and we can always diagonalize it. We choose a suitable basis, and then it's diagonal. And what we then see is that when the sigma mu nu is diagonal, what we then see is that the eigenvalues are describing the rate at which the geodesics are either getting further away from each other or getting closer to each other. Because if you remember the equation that B was governing, it was on the left-hand side, the time derivative of eta, of the vector that pointed from one geodesic to the other. And on the right-hand side, you had B applied to eta. So when you had an eigenvalue that was larger than 1, you would have that the distance is increasing between geodesics. If it's smaller than 1, then the distance is decreasing, in fact, exponentially so. So you might think that, therefore, the sigma matrix is describing the possibility for a bundle of geodesics to expand or to shrink. It kind of does, but with a caveat. Remember that the trace of, the eigenvalues, no, the point is not that the eigenvalues are smaller or larger than 1, but smaller or larger than 0. Right? So if the eigenvalues are 0, then you have an exponential with a negative exponent, and therefore the geodesics get closer. If the eigenvalue is positive, then you get that the solution to the equation is an exponential with a positive coefficient, and so they are exponentially fast moving apart from each other. So the caveat here is that even though the sigma mu matrix can describe geodesics that move away from each other or get closer to each other, actually, the trace of sigma, by construction of sigma, is vanishing, which means that the sum of the eigenvalues has to be 0. Therefore, there's always as much expansion going on as there is contraction in the other direction. So if you start with a circle of geodesics, then it will be changed in shape, but if it is expanding in one direction, it must be contracting in the other direction. And one can show that the volume spanned actually stays the same. Remember that these are infinitesimal generators here. So you have to actually exponentiate these things to get the full story of how these things behave. The matrix sigma mu nu is called the shear tensor, and you can visualize it this way: that if you have a geodesic, if you have a family of geodesics that form a tube, it becomes elliptic. If you have a family of geodesics that forms a square, for example, then it becomes a parallelogram that's somehow tilted. So it is called the shear tensor. Whereas the antisymmetric tensor, the twist tensor that we just had earlier, had the ability to rotate a cube, but not shear it. The sigma tensor has the ability to shear, but not to rotate. And of course, in general, you could have that both are non-zero, sigma and omega, in which case you would have a combination of a shearing and a rotation. But both the twist and shear tensors are traceless by construction, and therefore, as one can show, volume preserving. You see, when you take a square and you shear it, you leave the volume the same. And when you take a square and you rotate it, it also leaves the volume the same. So let's look at the last part, namely the traceful part, T mu nu, which is 1/3 of the what we call the expansion, and H mu nu. And so it slowly starts becoming plausible why we would call the theta the expansion. it is the traceful part. So for example, the T mu nu could be a symmetric matrix that is, if we diagonalize that, H mu nu, that is simply proportional to the identity. And what that means is, it's positive proportional to the identity or negative proportional to the identity, but proportional to the identity. And what that means is that the eta vector, the vector field that points from a geodesic to the neighboring geodesic, that would exponentially grow or decrease. I'm saying exponentially, but that's if there was nothing else going on. right? If this was the only thing that was going on. But of course, the shear and the twist and the expansion, they change over time and they interact with each other. So this is the infinitesimal generation of expansion, shear, or twist. So what we have in the expansion tensor is that if the B matrix consists of only the TMU nu matrix, or if this is the dominant part of the TMU nu matrix, then we have that the time derivative of the eta is proportional to the eta. Right? That's what it says. And therefore, depending on whether the theta is positive or negative, we have either an expansion, we have either that the congruence of geodesics gets blown apart, or we have that the shrink, that distances shrink. This means that in order now to detect geodesic, in order to detect singularities, our task is to see what theta does. As I said before, the B matrix holds the secret. If the B matrix goes singular, so does the distance between geodesics. And that's how we identify the presence of singularities. And now we identified that in the B matrix, what really matters when it comes to expansion and shrinkage is the theta. It's the prefactor in the part, in the traceful part of B, the part that can make geodesics, that can make families of geodesics shrink or expand. So what we need to find out is, how does the B matrix behave as we go along the geodesic? But also, but really what only matters in the B matrix is this part. So what we need to know is, how does theta behave in time? As we travel along a geodesic, how does theta, the expansion parameter, behave? All right, this is just repeating what I just said. The singularity theorem claims, in effect, that this quantity is going to diverge necessarily under some weak conditions, such as on a space-like hypersurface, we have initially some divergence of the geodesics, some overall expansion rate of the universe, that is to say, and the strong energy condition. Then from that, we want to prove that theta blows up at a certain point, at a certain finite point back in time. And that blowing up is literally then the Big Bang. So let us look at the evolution of theta, the expansion. And the equation that we get to study here is the Rai-Chaudhuri equation. I'm not sure about the pronunciation of that name. And it is important in astrophysics in general because it tells you how a flow of geodesics behaves under extreme circumstances. Even when you cannot solve the equations explicitly, this gives you some handle about general properties of the flow. So let us look at the expansion theta. So we consider again, let's see. Okay, let's summarize where we are so that we can then take the final jump and get to the conclusion. Final push to prove the thing. So we are considering a congruence of time-like geodesics through an initial space-like hypersurface sigma. And we are considering a one-parameter subfamily of this geodesics. Here's the picture again that we had earlier. Remember, this was equal time, is to say equal proper time of the geodesics. And this is equal S parameter. Each geodesic has its own value for S. Eta is pointing from geodesic to geodesic. Xi is pointing along the geodesic. The singularity theorem now claims that this happened in the past. Namely, that if you go back in time, you find that this eta shrinks to zero, forced by an expansion parameter theta. Basically, we're predicting here Big Bang, where geodesics had an initial expansion rate of infinity. We're saying that at a Big Bang, the theta was infinite. That obviously can't happen for a non-singular space-time. All right? So the equation that we showed needed to be solved is this. We want to know how does eta change over time, so the covariant derivative in the direction of time. And then here, the B matrix that governed how eta is changing over time, the B matrix was this. So we showed that at the along the geodesic psi, the deviation vector eta that points to the next geodesic changes its direction and length as governed by B. It's B nu mu acting on eta that is here on the right-hand side and tells us how eta is changing along the geodesic. Then we decompose the B matrix in this way into the anti-symmetric and the symmetric part, and this is the traceful part, which is the one that contains the expansion. And explicitly, we found that the anti-symmetric part is this part, and what it does is that it takes a ring of geodesics and makes it rotate around itself. The symmetric traceless part will squish rings of geodesics into ellipses. And then volume changing, these are volume preserving, and volume changing is the expansion part, which can actually take rings of geodesics and make them larger or smaller. Theta was defined to be the trace of B, or was shown to be the trace of B. And H mu is the projector onto the directions which are orthogonal to our time directions, orthogonal to the geodesics. So then what is the dynamics of theta? Here's the Ray-Chowdhury equation, the derivation of the Ray-Chowdhury equation. We remember what the definition of the matrix B was. The matrix B is covariant derivative of psi. Now, remember the curvature tensor obeys the Ricci equation. Remember what that means? It means that if you parallel transport a vector, xi, in the b direction, and then in the c direction, and then back in the c direction, back in the b direction, you obtain a rotated vector xi. Namely, b and c define the parallelogram, and the remaining matrix, RAD, is a Lorentz transformation. It's a rotation matrix, it's a generalized rotation matrix that tells you how the vector xi has been rotated on its trip around the parallelogram. That was the Ricci equation. So we will use these two ingredients for the Ray-Chowdhury equation, and C is another ingredient. We have that the vector field xi is a vector field that is tangent to a bunch of geodesics. It's in fact the time direction for the proper time direction for each of these geodesics. So xi obeys that the covariant derivative of xi in the direction of xi is zero. It's a parallel transport of a tangent vector of a geodesic in the direction of the geodesic is zero. And we can write out what that is. So we have that this is equal to zero. If we spell it out, we have that zero is equal to covariant derivative of this vector in that direction. This xi a can be pulled in front. That's what we did here. And then remember that this covariant derivative acting on this coefficient function times that vector by the Leibniz rule gives you an ordinary derivative of xi plus Christoffel symbols from the covariant derivative of e in the direction of that other e. In other words, these two terms can be written as a semicolon. It's the covariant derivative of the coefficient functions. then this is true for all basis vectors E. And therefore, we can write down that equation here without referring to the basis vectors. It's got to be true for all B. And therefore, that is true for every vector field that is obtained in this way, which is consisting of the tangent vectors to a bundle of, to a congruence of geodesics. Okay, so the three ingredients are the definition of the matrix B, the Ricci equation, and the knowledge that our time-like geodesics obey this condition. Now let's calculate, using A, B, and C, let's calculate the range, the rate of change of B, the matrix that governs how neighboring geodesics behave. Of course, eventually we will take a trace of it, so that the only thing that's left over from the B is the expansion theta. But we start out with the full matrix B, keep it general as long as we can. So first, let's write down the covariant derivative of B in the direction of the geodesics. Right? We want to know how does B change in the direction of the geodesics. In other words, the B itself, once you know it, tells you what the neighboring geodesics are going to do. Rotate about each other, circles going to ellipses, or perhaps a shrinkage or expansion. But how does this matrix B itself change over time along the geodesics? To find that out, we have to calculate the derivative of B in the direction of the vector fields, of the vector field psi, which is along the geodesics. Okay, so what is this then? So we have this coefficient psi and then semicolon C. We know what the definition of B is. It was the derivative of psi in the direction of B. So therefore, what we have is that this is that expression. Now remember that we have the Ricci equation. The Ricci equation tells us that if you go along a parallelogram and parallel transport a vector, it's going to be parallel transported, right? And this expression is therefore equal to that expression plus that one. We're using, in the Ricci equation, one term from the left-hand side and shift the other term to the right-hand side. All right, now this term here, we can write as that term minus this. You see this? If you take that term and you differentiate it semicolon B, then you get that term here, right? But by the product rule, you also get the term psi differentiated with respect to B and then that. So we have to subtract that term because it wasn't here. So we have to subtract it, and here's the subtraction. And that's just carried forward. That term, however, is vanishing because we're dealing with geodesics here. And therefore, we just have this term and that term carried forward. But here we recognize the B matrix and the B matrix again. So we have B matrix plus that. Almost there. So what we've derived is that the rate of change of the B matrix along the geodesics is given by B matrix plus R xi xi. Let's call that equation star. The trace of that equation will be the Reich-Chowdhury equation. But before, let us remember that the xi vector field, the tangent field to the all of the of our bunch of our congruence of geodesics is d by d tau. And let us remember that the trace of the B matrix, trace of the B matrix, we will calculate in a moment, in the sense that it's a B matrix and then contracted with the metric, is the expansion that we are after. So on the left-hand side of our equation here, we have that if we take the trace of it, so the trace of the equation star on the left-hand side is going to be the time derivative of theta. Because xi, covariant derivative with respect in the direction of xi, is the derivative with respect to the proper time of the geodesics. So that's d by d tau. And the trace of b is the expansion theta. So the left-hand side is going to be d by d tau of theta. Now on the right-hand side, we have this decomposition that B can be written as omega plus sigma. Omega plus sigma plus theta h mu nu, the endosymmetric part, the symmetric traceless, and the symmetric traceful part. And we plug that into here. And we get, of course, 9 terms. Because B has 3 terms, and here we have to calculate B squared. But we'll have to go through this, so let's calculate what that is. On the right-hand side of this equation, we now have that the b squared has these 9 terms. It's the omega times the b, the sigma times the b, and the traceful part times the b. It turns out that because of anti-symmetry, symmetry and tracelessness, only these diagonal terms are left over. All of the other terms go away. Let's not go through the details of why each one of them vanishes. So when we then take the trace of this equation to obtain the famous Rai-Chaudhuri equation, then of this b squared expression, once we take the trace of it, only 3 terms survive. And we have that the trace of this b term is given by, well, this omega times omega, plus sigma times sigma term, plus the expansion squared term. Now we are ready to put it all together. And we obtain that the Rai-Chaudhuri equation is the trace of the equation with the red star over there. On the left-hand side, we have the time derivative of the expansion, as we said. And on the right-hand side, we have all of this. We have this term here. Well, here we have a trace. We have HAB, HAB. And it turns out that if you just plug in what this projector is, HAB, HAP is simply 3. And here we have a 1 over 9 from 1 over 3 here. So we have 3 times 1 over 9. We're left with a minus 1/3. So that term ended up here. And then we have this term is carried forward over here. That term is carried forward over here. If you wonder why there are minus signs, it's because the original equation had a minus b squared term. That's why that's there. Minus signs are super important in this. Well, and here we have that term, right? That's left over from the expression a little earlier. Oh my God, now we're getting music. See, from here. If you take the trace of that with the G mu nu matrix, you're just left with the Ricci tensor here. And that is where the strong energy condition comes from. You see, this expression is always positive because we are squaring a matrix here and here as well. Of course, with a minus sign, they are always going to be negative. Now, this expression here is the key. If we knew that it is also positive, this thing here, if we knew that for sure, then we could say, oh, that's great. D theta by d tau, always negative, right? Because all terms in there are always negative. But we don't really know that for sure, do we? Because the Ricci tensor could be anything. So therefore, at this point, the pioneers of this sort of singularity theorem said, well, let's just assume it is positive. Let's just assume it's positive because otherwise we are stuck with our proof. Let's just assume it's positive, go on with our proof, prove the existence of singularities, like a cosmological singularity in our past, prove the existence of a Big Bang, and then worry about it later, what that means. What it means to require that this is always positive. So, let us assume now that the Ricci tensor contracted with time-like vector fields is always positive for all time-like psi. But that means that using the Einstein equation, this becomes a condition on the matter content of our universe. It means because of the Einstein equation, remember the Einstein equation can be written in this form. Only in 3 plus 1 dimensions can the Einstein equation be also written in this form. Remember, we know it in the form where the rows of r and t are interchanged, right? But that's true too. So what we see is that that necessary condition in order to have a definite sign in the equation that we had before, that everything on the right-hand side was negative, which is crucial, as we will see in a moment, to prove the singularity theorem, in order to make sure that this term doesn't spoil it, we simply assume that the matter content of the universe is such that r min u is larger or equal to zero, which is to say, is such that the matter content of the universe has to be such that this expression contracted with psi in this way. So instead of r min u contracted with twice psi, we can contract this twice with psi, that this is larger or equal to zero. And that is the strong energy condition. That's where this is from. And it's very nice to see, as we discussed earlier, that the strong energy condition is also exactly the condition that you have to impose on matter so that it does not want to inflate space-time. Right? That was exactly the threshold. When you diagonalize T mu nu, you find that the condition on rho and on P is that the ratio of P to rho is not smaller than a third. Right? That's what it means. That's what the strong energy condition means. It means that the ratio of pressure to energy density is not smaller than a third, not smaller than minus a third. But remember that the threshold of that ratio being minus a third is the threshold from which onwards matter would want to inflate space-time, would make the expansion rate accelerate. So it's very plausible that this is exactly what is needed here, that you need ordinary kind of matter that doesn't inflate space-time. So if we now assume the strong energy condition, then we can conclude from the Rai-Chaudhuri equation that everything on its right-hand side is negative. And in particular, if we neglect all the terms other than the expansion, we can write here that d theta by d tau plus a third theta squared is small or equal to zero, right? This was initially on the right-hand side plus other negative stuff. And we can put it on the left-hand side and still conclude that all of this is negative. So what's the benefit of that? Well, now from the Rai-Chaudhuri equation, we have this equation, we have that equation, right? We just divided by minus theta squared to go from here to here. Two things happen. We divide it by theta squared, so we get it over here. We don't have it over there anymore. And because we divided by a negative thing, minus theta squared, we also flipped the inequality here. But this expression can now conveniently be written as d by d tau of the inverse of theta. Because if you differentiate that, you get 1 over theta squared, minus 1 over theta squared, times the derivative of theta. So this is the key equation that will give us the singularity theorem, or that will give us the... this is what will force that the expansion blows up. This is what will force that there was a singularity in the past. So let us consider two cases here. Namely, let's consider the case where the geodesics are initially either all diverging, so we have that the universe is expanding, our geodesics are drifting apart, and that would be the case where the expansion rate is initially positive. Right? So we have that the expansion theta is positive at time t naught. That's an expanding universe. In this case, we want to know, does that mean that there was in the past an explosion? And the answer will be yes. if the strong energy condition holds, then we can conclude that in the past there must have been an explosion. Of course, a scalar field with a potential, like an inflation, could invalidate that. But if you don't have that, as if you just have a matter content in the universe that obeys the strong energy condition, so the equation of state parameter never drops to below minus a third, then we want to show that there was a singularity in the past. Another initial condition we can consider is that at the time t naught, the universe is shrinking. The geodesics are converging to each other. So we could also consider as the initial condition here that the expansion rate is actually negative at a particular point in time. Now, we are not living in a universe like this just yet. Actually, everything is expanding. But it could be that it will eventually recollapse. And then we would find ourselves in a universe in which geodesics are converging. Now, then we could ask, does that mean that there is a big crunch singularity in our future? The same theorem would apply to that case, assuming that the strong energy condition holds. So, case A. Imagine that, let me just show you again the equation because it's so important. So d by dt of theta inverse is larger than a third. Okay, d by dt of theta inverse is larger than a third. Okay, so I'm plotting here theta inverse. The d by dt of theta inverse is larger than a third, right? Remember that's what we derived. So theta inverse is on this scale here. When theta inverse is here, it's negative, it's fine. It's some expansion theta. If it's over there, theta inverse is fine. It's some expansion theta. But if theta is here, if theta inverse is zero, it means that theta is infinite. Right? So if that happens, if theta goes infinite, that's when we have either a big crunch or we have a big bang. So theta inverse is always, the derivative of theta inverse is always larger than a third. That's what we just showed under the assumption of the strong energy condition. But what that means is this. Imagine this is today. T naught is today. And we have that the universe is now expanding. This is the case A, where the divergence is positive. So we have that theta inverse is positive. So we are somewhere here, right? So here, that's what why I put the little cross there. That's where we are now. This is now, and the expansion is positive. So we are at some point here. For convenience, I drew here the line of slope a third. Okay, this is a line of slope one third. And we know that the derivative of theta inverse has to have a slope which is larger than a third. So let's follow our curve back in time. Whichever way it went back in time, this curve must have had a slope which is larger than a third. So, for example, we could not go that way, right? This, our curve, our timeline here, the theta inverse as a function of tau, followed back in time, could not go like this because the slope would be shallower than a third, would be less than a third. So instead, our curve must stay underneath that line of slope one third. But that means that we must hit the axis at some point. Right? So if we could have that the slope is smaller than a third, then we might avoid it, go that way. But the slope has to be larger than a third, and therefore this has to be steeper than that curve, and therefore we have to meet the axis, and that means that theta inverse has to go to zero at a finite point in time backwards. which means that theta, the expansion itself, must go to infinity at a finite time in the past, which means that we must have had this tremendous explosion at a finite time in the past. On the other hand, let's consider at the situation B, where the universe is shrinking. And at a particular point in time on our space-like hypersurface, we have that the geodesics are converging towards each other. And that means that the theta inverse is negative to start with, right? Because the theta is negative. So it's a shrinkage. In this case, let's look at our time now, t naught, and we have a negative theta, so I'm just plotting a point arbitrarily here. That's the point where we are now, if the universe was now shrinking. Well, then again, I drew for you the line of slope 1/3. We know that the curve d theta by dt the curve theta inverse of tau must have a slope d theta inverse by d tau, which is larger than 1/3, which means that the curve here from today into the future must stay above that line, because the slope has to be larger than 1/3. And so as we go with the slope larger than 1/3, we must eventually hit the axis. But at the axis, there is doom, right? Because it means that theta inverse goes to 0, which means that theta goes to infinity. Well, from the negative side, right? So everything gets infinitely crunched. So we see that theta inverse either hits, in the case of the Big Bang singularity, a 0 at a finite time in the past, or the Big Crunch singularity, a 0 in the finite time in the future. Now, these singularity theorems are avoidable, but, let me just go through the slide to be consistent here. So what we showed is that theta inverse must go through 0, that is to say, for sufficiently early tau in the case A of a Big Bang singularity, we must have had that the expansion rate went to infinity, a Big Bang, and otherwise, in the other case, we had a Big Crunch. this type of reasoning leads also to further cosmological singularity theorems. For example, another cosmological singularity theorem can do without an assumption of global hyperbolicity, and its conclusion is a little weaker, namely that there is at least one incomplete geodesic. So it means that somewhere in the past something went singular, but it doesn't mean everywhere. That I will leave to next time. I just wanted to close by saying that already there are ways out of these singularity theorems. Namely, we seem to be saved from a Big Crunch in the future by the presence of a cosmological constant, which makes the universe accelerate rather than slow down and ever re-collapse. On the other hand, there may not have been a Big Bang either. And that's because the strong energy condition was probably violated. I mean, if the standard model of cosmology is right, then very, very early on, the inflaton field had a value such that its potential was very large, was larger than its kinetic terms, remember? And that meant that temporarily the equation of state parameter was close to -1, which led to the huge inflation very, very early on. And whether you actually have a cosmological constant or you have it only temporarily as mimicked by a potential of an inflaton field makes no difference. In both cases, you have that you run up against the strong energy condition. And so, for example, it is possible, as we discussed a few lectures ago, that our universe was spawned from a mother universe when there was a quantum fluctuation that led to elevated energy in a localized region. So we cannot actually infer from that theorem that our universe must have had a Big Bang. It might just have, you know, mushroomed out of a previous universe. And the way out of this theorem is that even though we do have that now, for example, on our space-like hypersurface, the geodesics, the congruence of geodesics defined by the galaxies, for example, certainly do have divergence. They do expand. And in the past, they would have shrunk. So in principle, it looks like we could conclude that there must have been a singularity. But not so, because inflation may just in the last minute, so to speak, prevented, and not the last minute, the first minute, it might have prevented that singularity by going around the assumption of the strong energy condition. Well, and now you've seen what goes into this, and as I said, there is a hope that singularities might be avoided altogether. Singularities are not just, it would be nice to avoid the presence of singularities, not just because they are places where things go infinite, but because they would show the limitations of our laws of nature. Because at that point where there's a singularity, we would just throw up our hands and say, we don't know what's going on. It would be nice if we had a self-contained theory that doesn't predict its own demise, just as general relativity does. And so there's a hope that, for example, black holes may not really have a singularity, that maybe the universe didn't come from a singularity. And in the case of black holes, it might be that quantum fluctuations somehow get around the singularity theorems that analogously to here would predict that infalling shell of matter would have to produce a black hole if certain weak conditions are met. So there's still lots to be found out. Okay, that's it for today. See you on Thursday then. If you have any questions, let me know.